So we know Sky News. Looks like it died. Murdoch's news died. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news. It's the leader of the Green Group and councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down, Eleanor Cumley. Eleanor Cumley. I think I pronounced it right, finally. After the 6 o'clock news, homage to Catalonia as the Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy and King Felipe, backed by Donalds, that is Donalds, Trump and Tusk, as well as our own Foreign Office and the French President Emmanuel Macron, they're vowing to overturn Sunday's independence referendum last week, whilst the suspended Catalan Parliament planned to hold a debate and vote on unilateral declaration of independence on Monday. Some are asking, what have happened to the European Declaration of Human Rights and democracy? We look at the Gürtel scandal over in Spain and explain why the courts might not be as independent as we might hope. Plus carnage in Las Vegas. Nearly 60 concertgoers shot dead and everybody who knew Stephen Paddock saying they can't believe he'd do such a thing. Yet there his dead body was in the Hotel Mandalay room with over an hour before the shooting ended and the SWAT team forced their way into Paddock's room. Could there be another explanation? The rather shy FBI aren't telling us. Plus, the Israeli Talpiot programme. Why is it that they spent so much of the annual grant they get from the US in getting Israeli geniuses into every high-tech sector, including our military? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hot spots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, rain in the early hours. This weekend, highs of 16. It's cloudy tomorrow with showers in the morning. Dry and bright, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 18, sunny spells and some wet and windy weather midweek. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of October, highs still around 18. Sounds pretty warm to me. And sunny spells and wet and windy weather. If you're going out, Sunday seems to be the day. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is leader of the Green Group and councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down, Eleanor Cumley. Oh, gosh. Say it again, Eleanor. Come on. Or maybe we'll all remember it.
Cumley.
Okay. If I get it wrong again, you can slap me. Right. So first of all, we have a sort of a... I don't think crisis is the right word, but I just slap myself on the forehead and say, why is it that all the other cities pretty much have got a chief executive who's in charge of running at least having somebody with their head around what's going on, but Bristol doesn't need one?
It's a very interesting question. I think that part of the driver for it is that to get a good chief exec, we were advised the salary would be 190,000. And I think amongst people in Bristol, there isn't really the stomach for someone on that kind of a salary.
But I mean, on a budget of whatever it is, 300 something million pounds a year, I mean, that's peanuts really, isn't it? If you're looking at the bigger picture. And this person, the idea is that you do need to have someone who's got their head around the way all that money's being spent. I mean, this is peanuts.
But that would require the mayor, Marvin, to put himself out there and have that argument with people, and I don't think that's something that he's got the stomach for, to be honest.
But he doesn't really seem to be explaining why we don't need one. I mean, the other thing is that we've got this Metro Mayor now, which is this sort of Uber Super Mayor. I mean, I'm very cynical. I think that this was whole thing was confected by a bunch of Tories to say, well, look, if we have votes in Bristol, we're never going to get in. But if we extend the boundary sort of 20 miles outside the city, right around the rich kind of stockbroker belt around Bristol, then we can win. And that's what they've done. But I mean, that It does seem to me that the power, by taking away a chief executive, you're kind of reducing the power and the influence of, and the coordination, really, of what's going on here in Bristol and how our taxpayers' money is being spent. And Tim Bowles, the Metro Mayor, will be smiling.
Quite possibly. I think that my main concern of what I've seen so far is how much it shifts power into political hands and requires the mayor to take on an administrative role. So it's not entirely clear whether that would be the chain of command, but it does look like the mayor is getting much more involved in the nitty-gritty. And really, we elect a politician to set a broader policy direction. We don't really elect a politician to make sure the post-it notes get ordered.
So do you think Marvin sees himself as Bristol's managing director?
It does look a little like that from the charts we've seen. But at the moment, this is very much a lovely diagram, and we are still waiting for it to be fleshed out.
Okay, can you just paint a picture of this diagram? Obviously, this is radio; it's not the easiest thing to do.
I realize
that's a bit of a googly to bowl you. But if you could just give us a bit of an idea of how this is supposed to work.
So
it would have been lovely to have Marvin in here. He was due to be in here 2 weeks ago and just pulled out at the last minute. But you know, I'm trying as hard as I can every week, phoning the office. Come on, Marvin, he just doesn't either respond or whatever. But anyway, this is your opportunity, Ellen, to do it for him.
Okay, so at the top of the tree, I'm doing this from memory, so apologies if I miss out any service directors. At the top of the tree, you have the mayor, and beside him is the mayor's office. So that's his political assistants, his policy assistants, the officers who have a political flavour, who work directly for the mayor and answer to the mayor.
So who are they, those ones with the political flavour, the officers who are directly working? Is that like within the mayor's office?
Yes. So then below the mayor, we have three sort of strategic leaders who will each have responsibility for an area of the council's work. And below them, we have 15 directors who will be responsible for a smaller area and will actually be the people who get things done.
Is it going to work?
At the moment, it's hard to tell because there really isn't much meat on these bones. It's very much, Marvin was talking about in the last cabinet meeting about how he's focused on delivery, but what he has delivered is a diagram. And what we don't have yet are clear job descriptions, or they haven't been sent to us yet. We don't have clear job descriptions for these roles. We don't know what detailed responsibilities they have. We don't know how this structure maps to the cabinet structure. So we have councillors, cabinet members, who have political control of particular areas of the council's work. It isn't clear how they map onto this structure of officers who actually do the council work.
Now, I noticed in the Bristol Post this week, some councillors from the Lib Dems, the Lib Dem leader Gary Hopkins and Richard Eddy, who's another one I keep trying to phone up, email, persuade to come on the radio. He never will. Never, like in whatever it is now, nearly 10 years, even though he's been a councillor all that time. Come on, Richard, let's hear you. They are saying that Marvin Rees is saying that they're untrustworthy and irresponsible, that the mayor is lashing out recklessly due to embarrassment. Two councillors are denying any wrongdoing after the Bristol mayor called them untrustworthy and irresponsible for speaking out against the appointment process of the former chief executive. Councillor Richard Eddy and Lib Dem group leader Gary Hopkins maintain they were correct to raise concerns over Anna Klonowski gained her job and have accused Marvin Rees of lashing out recklessly due to embarrassment. Now, we're getting a picture of Marvin as just kind of wanting to run the show. He doesn't seem to be like the first among equals in any way. He just seems to be wanting to direct things in a almost like a feudal manner.
That's one way of putting it. I think that Marvin talks a lot about wanting to be open. He talks a lot about wanting to work together. He talks a lot about wanting to get away from the sort of narrow confines of party politics. But we don't see a lot of that actually happening.
No, we had a discussion with Tim Kent a couple of weeks ago about the appointment process for the former chief executive, Anna. We'll leave her second name for now. And Anna was appointed at a meeting where no minutes were taken, apparently, and also that some of the people who were on that panel had no HR experience or no HR qualifications. And also that a bit later in the week, one of the Labour councillors who was on that committee, who had said that she didn't think that Anna would be appropriate, then said that she did think she would be appropriate and found herself with a cabinet position as a result. So you do wonder that it does seem to me as if this is a sort of sharp practice business kind of technique rather than the way to run a city openly and accountably. And Marvin has said very clearly that that's the way he wants to do things.
I don't think you can necessarily read anything into someone getting a cabinet position sometime later, because there are only 70 councillors. It's a fairly limited pool of talent. And if you've already fallen out with a few, then that pool is narrower still.
It really shouldn't matter if you fall out with anybody. You should be putting, surely, the people who are most talented in the positions in the cabinet, people with the most experience, people you think have got the vision.
I think that it's not just Marvin and it's not just George Ferguson. I think it's a fundamental flaw to the mayoral model that it concentrates too much power into too few hands. And it does, as you say, lend itself to feudalism.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this basic kind of procedure for getting rid of a chief executive, you're happy with that?
Well, I have to say, I learn more about what's going on by coming on this show than I do in the rest of the week. So the gossip I generally pick up by coming on the show. I think there is a problem about having a mayoral system. I wasn't in favour of having a mayoral system. And the other point is, of course, that the Labour Party has a majority on the council and they won the mayoral election. They don't, in fact, have to share power with anybody. And the rules are that Marvin could, if he wanted to, run the place as Boris Johnson used to run London, as, you know, he's in charge and that's that. And, of course, he doesn't want to do that, and I think that's right. And we've got an all-party coalition running Bristol, which is probably the only one in the country, I would have thought. So we're trying to do things in a rather different way here. In a sense, building upon what George Ferguson tried to do. And of course, the other thing is we've got to make millions of pounds worth of cuts, which nobody wants to do. So now, it's not really a nice situation.
Marvin has had a few things to say through the BBC. And of course, you know, I would suggest that the BBC give him quite a nice, easy ride when they interview him, far more than he'd get on here, I hope. Anyway, he's been saying that the role of the council has to change. This is his kind of we're scrapping the chief executive statement. He says increasing demand for our services and shrinking budgets mean we cannot continue to operate with a traditional provider model. Do you know what that means, Eleanor? Provider model?
I think he means that we will do less of actually doing things and more of generally encouraging other people to do them.
Pen pushing. Okay, anyway, it's a bit of Marvin speak, provider model. I don't know quite what that means. Anyway, we'll see if we can find some sort of definition of what that means. But anyway, we must redefine our role and our relationship with the city. Can we just replace this with I? I must define my role in the relationship with the city. I have developed a proposed senior management structure at strategic and service director level. In doing so, I am taking the opportunity to create a smaller team who will work with partners on delivery of my priority outcomes. It does seem to be very much more being personalised, but this actually could be a kind of almost like a kind of business model for running the city, Eleanor, couldn't it? There might be something potentially positive about this, in that Marvin can control things much better and make sure that he gets the outcomes that he wants and the vision that he wants.
Possibly. I think that the reason for having people who are not politicians but are professionals working in the council is that they can become expert in their the particular skill set they need. When someone stands to be mayor, they don't, we don't match them up carefully against the job spec and choose the person who's got administration skills or who's got management skills. They're elected because they represent the kind of vision that the majority of people want for the city. That doesn't necessarily mean they have the skills to make that happen. And you could have someone quite inexperienced coming into the role who just doesn't have the skills to manage an organisation the size of the council. So they do need support from officers. Now, I'm not wedded to the idea of a chief executive. I think my main concern with this reorganisation is that I don't see a clear roadmap from how we get from where we are to where the beautiful diagram says we should be. I don't know what the interim procedures are. I don't know what the interim lines of command are. So for the next few months, if someone in my ward has a problem with a certain area of the council, I am literally not going to know who to go to.
Well, that is worrying. Also, we've got another kind of running sore right now for Marvin. Is this, although, of course, he's supposed to be a Labour mayor, he's introducing this consultation over council tax for people with no money. Now, it doesn't really sound more like somewhere to the far right of Tory, but yet this is something that Marvin is possibly about to introduce, and he may be trying to do it illegally. Eleanor, can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes.
We had a consultation, didn't we, over a few months?
Yes.
About how people, whether people think that we should be demanding money or threatening jail and fines for people with no money. And this, it looks as if it may be being implemented quite soon.
I can object to this on so many levels. To first take your point about the possible illegality of the consultation, there was a consultation in Haringey which was found to be illegal because it didn't clearly lay out that there were other options to making the cut. So, for example, you might say we could have a referendum on putting up council tax across the board rather than focusing a huge rise on the very poorest households in the city. You could make cuts in other areas of service. And Haringey clearly did not lay out the alternative options well enough, and their consultation was found to be illegal. So our consultation, the Bristol consultation, that has mixed reviews, I would say. Clearly, the only options available, if you choose an option from the consultation, the only options are to cut the support in some way. There are no alternatives offered. The council, the mayor has advised us that his advice is that it's good enough. What's been done in the consultation is good enough to be legal. But I'm not a lawyer. I can't tell you whether he's right.
As far as I know, Martin, we have the same laws in force in Bristol as in Haringey, don't we?
Well, indeed. I mean, obviously, again, this is very detailed stuff. But I think the idea of trying to chase people on very small, low incomes for council tax, I did some research for Bristol Debt Advice Centre some years ago. The problem is you don't get much money from it. These people are poor. So you've got officers chasing people down. And when you finally bring them to court and you finally get the money out of them, you're getting £200 off them.
I mean,
which doesn't pay the salaries of the people doing the chasing.
What is the point of criminalising the poor, Martin? Yeah.
There is no point. Well, the real problem is the council tax shouldn't exist at all. It's a regressive tax on people instead of a tax on property.
But it does
exist. In Northern Ireland, they still have the rating system.
Yeah,
because they didn't
the fact is it does exist, and Marvin Rees, it looks like, is going to be bringing this scheme in. And
well, I mean, as a member of the Labour Party, I'm quite happy to oppose that because for practical reasons, there's no real saving to be made by chasing these people on low incomes.
Well,
for
Green Councillor Carla Denyer has suggested that the refusal to disclose evidence to councillors about how this was legal was in contrast to the mayor's frequently espoused commitment to transparent government and an open door policy. Right, well, that's not very transparent and it's not very open door, Marvin, is it, if you think what you're doing is legal? And Councillor Denyer continued, Marvin's words on transparency are laudable, but he sometimes needs to follow through in his actions, holding a consultation that offers people no real choice and then hiding the legal justification for the said consultation from opposition councillors. Hardly seems like open government.
Yes, that's very true. And that's the position we're in at the moment. But I think your point, Martin, was absolutely right, that pursuing people who have no money for money is a lousy business plan. If you're aiming to bring more money into the council, then trying to get that from people who have least is just not a sensible way forward. Interestingly, Camden Council have recently brought back 100% council tax reduction scheme because they realised that they were spending so much on recovery and getting so little back that it just wasn't worth the trouble.
Well, you know what? It sounds ironic, but I'm reminded of Nantes in France, who introduced their guided rail bus back about 10 years ago, very much exactly, basically, it's identical to the Metro bus, which is this bus that goes on a guided rail for a while, but then also goes on the road. 3 years later, they decided to scrap it and turn it into a proper tram, and it cost them an absolute fortune. Maybe we're going to be in the same situation with this council tax thing, where it's obvious, it's out there, that this isn't going to work, but we're going to try anyway. And actually, I don't think that's really what people voted for, Martin, when they voted Labour.
No, they didn't. And I'm quite sure that grassroots Labour Party activists will be extremely unhappy if that's the road we're going down. And I suppose the only thing I can say is to reiterate what I said before about it's not a very efficient way to raise money. And the other thing, of course, what we really need to do is get a different basis for funding local government. Dare I say it, perhaps we'll have to bring back the rates, Tony, because the rates were introduced by Queen Elizabeth I and they lasted until Queen Margaret Thatcher got rid of them, and they lasted all those hundreds of years because it was the most effective way to fund local government, as it still is in Belfast and Derry.
We'll be talking in the second hour about Catalonia and about secession. And all these taxes being imposed on Bristol from Westminster, if you go to Italy, in Venice, which is, I suppose, a sort of comparable city, very, very ancient, medieval port, they now have actually quite a strong secessionist movement in Venice. They're considering having a referendum there in saying we've had enough of Rome, we're seceding, because we're in this situation, and maybe you can help us with this a bit, Martin, is that when taxes are raised, they are going to central government. But even in fairly wealthy cities, they're not seeing the reinvestment from central government. They're not seeing the money coming back. Most of that money is simply going in repayment of debt. And we know now that the national debt is at 1.5 trillion. Yes, interest rates are low, but the fantastic amount of the money that we're paying in taxes, income tax, every other tax, VAT, etc., is just going to the banks.
Well, that's right, because, of course, we bailed out the private banking system. Maybe we shouldn't have done that. There are free market economists who say, well, we should have allowed the banking system to collapse.
I mean, is this
I'm open to that argument.
Is this incompetence?
No, it's capitalism failing. And basically, capitalism failed in 2008. It's still failing now. And the reason why you've got budget deficits all over Europe and elsewhere in the world is because the private banking system was bailed out. The shareholders were made whole at the expense of the taxpayers.
Okay, so does capitalism need a kick up the backside?
It's dead. It's like it's a donkey that's dead and we're whacking it with a stick and it's not going to get up. And of course, this is one of the things that we don't talk about, is that we're on the brink, quite possibly, of another crash because of the bubble that's been created.
Martin, you've been saying that for years.
Well, it only happens once. Yeah. You only die once. And when you're dead, you're dead. Like a donkey.
Okay, Eleanor, what do you make of this? I mean, I don't know if we can call what Martin was saying there an analysis, but it's certainly an analogy. Okay, what do you make of the possibility that we really are in a bit of a financial stick here, and we are actually not moving really in any direction towards fixing?
I think capitalism has huge problems because you are aiming a system at putting money into the hands of people who have money. That's what capitalism means. It means that you put more money into the hands of those with capital. And that means that you can't focus the system on solving other problems. That if the aim of the system is to put money into the hands of the rich, then that is what it does, and that is what it does effectively. It doesn't ensure a basic standard of living for all. It doesn't ensure sustainable practice. It doesn't ensure that we have clean air and water and nice places to live. It doesn't ensure any of the things that we as individuals would like, because it's a system designed to move money into fewer hands.
Well, look, I know someone who disagrees with you, and he was speaking at the Conservative Party conference this week in Manchester. His name is Philip Hammond, and he's the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So he actually thinks that the economy is doing very well and that Britain is leading an international boom.
There is one fact, an inconvenient one for our opponents, that I just want to dwell on for a moment. Despite the debt and the deficit we inherited, despite the challenge Britain has faced, despite the difficulties of rebuilding an economy ravaged by recession, we can be proud that under this Conservative government, income inequality in this country has fallen to its lowest level in over three decades. And as a result of the hard work and resolution of the British people over the last 7 years, our debt is set to begin falling next year. Our economy today is fundamentally strong. We are well positioned for the future with our time zone, our legal system and our language. Last week's World Economic Forum league table shows the UK a more competitive place to do business than it has ever been. The UK is the world's number one digital economy. We led the world in the first industrial revolution, driven by steam and iron and our great engineering pioneers. In the 20th century, we helped give the world radio, television, the jet engine, and the computer. Mixed blessing, some would say, but we did it. And today, we are playing a leading role in what some have called a fourth industrial revolution, in which new technologies, robotics, artificial intelligence, big data, biosciences, are coming together to change the way our economy and our society works. Ladies and gentlemen, the future is coming, and we must be the party that embraces it, not fights it, because it is change that will deliver the progress we are committed to. We have a phalanx of entrepreneurs and investors who've taken these breakthrough technologies from the labs of our world-leading universities to the factories and business parks of Britain, creating the jobs and the wealth and, yes, the tax revenues that will sustain the Britain of the future.
Well, it's the sort of boilerplate you've got to expect from a Conservative Chancellor speaking to the Tory Party conference.
Also worth noting, a lot of people in the... I mean, there was a bit of applause, certainly nothing like the Theresa May speech or the Jeremy Corbyn speech last week. It was a very thin... It was, looking at the seats for Philip Hammond's speech, it was about probably two-thirds, three-quarters empty.
And those people were asleep, probably. I mean, the idea that we've had an economic miracle in Britain over the last few years is laughable. We lost our AAA credit rating during the first coalition government, if you remember, I interviewed Nick Clegg about that and said, you're going to lose the country's credit rating. He didn't seem to understand the question. And then they lost the country's credit rating. Didn't matter that much, but they were the ones who said it mattered. So how come the Conservatives lost our AAA credit rating? Because they tried to cut the public expenditure too far, too fast, which then led the economy to slow down, which then meant the deficit was supposed to have been reduced by now, but it hasn't been. And that's why the economy is still spluttering away, is because we haven't reduced the deficit. Most people don't really get this. The deficit is what keeps the economy going. If you cut the deficit too far, too fast, the economy will crash. And house prices are rising again now in Britain.
I think there's been some figures saying they're falling. But anyway, Eleanor, what about what Philip Hammond there is saying about income inequality? That at least is some good news. Income inequality.
I haven't seen the figures. I don't know exactly what he is counting there. I would have to look behind that headline.
You doubting his word?
I am not doubting his word. I'm just not clear what it means, I think,
The other point I would make is the real problem is not so much income inequality, it's wealth inequality. And if you actually look at the wealth, a distribution of wealth, and of course, ultimately, of course, that would be a much more sensible way to raise money.
What's the difference, Martin?
Wealth is what people actually have, you know, all of their assets. Income is just what they get on a weekly or yearly basis. And in actual fact, wealth inequality is getting bigger and bigger. And, of course, the ultimate...
So is that why Philip Hammond's focusing on income inequality? Because well, exactly, there's actually loads of people with vast amounts of money that don't really need an income?
Well, that's right. I mean, and if you talk about income inequality or even talk about income, nobody wants to talk about wealth. But, of course, back in the day, in the Middle Ages or whatever, people weren't taxed on income. They were taxed on wealth. So to fight the Hundred Years' War, there'd be a 15th or what they called a 15th. So a 15th of all the wealth of everybody in the country was handed over to the government to fight the war in France. And that's how taxes used to work. And, of course, that's what the rating system is based on. Housing or property is wealth, not income. And of course, moving towards income tax means that poor people have to pay it and so on, whereas wealth taxes only affect the wealthy. And, of course,
Could scrap income tax then in that case?
Well, you could if you had something like a land value tax or
Green
whatever.
Party policy is to have a land value tax, wealth tax, and to move away eventually from income tax altogether. And certainly away from a regressive tax like council tax.
Okay, so Philip Hammond was also giving us a bit of a history lesson. I think it's because too many left-wing historians like Martin keep painting out the Thatcher era as being quite negative in some ways. He wanted to explain, actually, it's not like that at all.
The new generation is being tempted down a dangerous path, and we have to explain why and how the market economy works and the role of competition as the consumer's friend. And colleagues, we have to make these arguments with confidence because they are true and they are timeless. Now, I can almost hear the alarm bells going off in Conference Control Centre. Don't talk about the 1970s. Look, I've got kids. I understand that we will not engage them simply by droning on about some previously fought war. I remember the winter of discontent. But I also know that the purpose of history is to learn lessons for the future. So although, to paraphrase William Hague again, some of us might just conceivably not be here in 40 years, I think we owe it to the next generation to show how Corbyn's Marxist policies will inevitably lead us back to where Britain was in the late 1970s. We know what state control does to industry. Utilities, transport, energy, steel, coal, mail, shipbuilding, telecoms, ports, airports, and much of our heavy manufacturing were all nationalised. All of them were massively inefficient, running up huge losses, because the unions knew that with the state as owner, they could not go bust. So the setting of wages and prices was determined by naked political power, not market forces. The losses those industries piled up and the capital they needed to keep going competed with our public services for scarce resources. The Labour government squared the circle by borrowing money. And when the lenders took fright at the mounting debt and the supply dried up, they had to go cap in hand to the IMF. Inflation reached 26.9% in 1975. Britain hemorrhaged talent as a brain drain of doctors, scientists, teachers and managers gathered pace. The skilled and the mobile abandoning Labour's utopia for a better life elsewhere. And who could blame them? Top rates of income tax were 83% on earnings and 98% on interest and dividends. Corporation tax was 52%. I certainly wouldn't envy Liam Fox's job of promoting investment in Britain on those terms. And unsurprisingly, there wasn't very much investment in Britain. So we slipped further and further behind our competitors. And as things got worse, the Labour government doubled down, tightening the screws, inflicting more misery on a country that was already the sick man of Europe, beating the patient, not treating it. Until in the winter of 1978, it finally fell apart. And in the election the following year, the British people voted to put Labour's failed experiment behind them, to abandon the stagnation, the hopelessness, and the national humiliation that socialism had heaped upon our proud nation. and to embrace the radical vision of economic liberation presented by Margaret Thatcher. Here endeth the history lesson. That election was a turning point for our nation. By abandoning the delusion that the state could run the economy, that we could borrow our way out of every problem, by embracing the discipline of the market and taking the hard decisions to put Britain back on track to sustainable growth, we not only rescued our economy, tamed inflation, and created the conditions that led to decades of rising living standards for the British people, but we blazed a trail of ideas that ultimately liberated the people of Eastern Europe, unleashed the boom in international trade, and allowed what we used to call the less developed economies to become the emerging economic giants of today.
Well, that's an extremely tendentious version of history, if you don't mind me saying so. And of course, he didn't really mention what happened in the 1980s when Britain was substantially deindustrialised, where we lost a huge section of our industry because of the dogmatic monetarism of the early Tory government.
But it had died in the 1970s under Labour.
Didn't die.
Yes, it did.
No, that we, well, we lost most of our industries in the early 1980s during the Thatcher recession. And in actual fact,
any industry with a corporation tax of 52% is not going to last 5 minutes.
Well,
Martin,
listen,
is it?
You don't actually have the top rate of tax during the Korean War in both United States and Britain was 98%.
1950s. Yeah.
Yes, that's
not the 1970s.
From 1945 until 1973 and the first oil price crisis, living standards rose substantially throughout the Western world because you had a mixed economy with a private sector being directed by a public sector which was substantial, particularly in this country. And of course, opinion polls now show that a majority of Tory voters want all of these industries back in public ownership.
So you're saying that the winter of discontent didn't happen?
The winter of discontent, Tony, happened because there was a 5% pay ceiling. Now, that meant that the people on the lowest pay, the people who collected the bins, the people who cleaned people's bottoms, got 5%. But 5% of not very much is not very much.
Well, that's a bit
and those people
well,
went
also,
on strike, rightly
when
so.
When inflation round about 26%.
Yes, and it went Geoffrey Howe was Chancellor, he increased VAT as a means of trying to balance the books, which then pushed up measured inflation, which then meant that they had to screw the economy even further down to get the inflation out. And during that period, we lost substantial chunks of our industry, which we will never get back. And in actual fact, the British...
we were going to get it back from the Labour conference.
We're not going to get what we had back before. And in any case, you don't want it back because it was old and everything moves on. The substantial mess, if you remember when Thatcher first came to power, a substantial number of economists, I think it was like 300-odd economists, wrote a letter, famous letter at the time, saying your policy is rubbish, it's going to cause chaos. And they were proved right. Thatcherism was a disaster for Britain, and when he
but
goes
there was
on about
chaos in 1978, 1979.
No, there wasn't chaos. Poor people at the bottom of the hierarchy went on strike because their wages weren't rising in line with inflation. And what had actually happened was the incomes policy pursued by a Labour government, which is a standard policy in places like Sweden, Norway, Denmark, broke down because it didn't have solidaristic bargaining built into it. In Sweden or Norway, they make sure that the people at the bottom of the pile always get a little bit extra. They don't just get the same as everybody else. They get a little bit extra to make sure that you're squeezing the wage differential.
Anyway,
and the Labour government couldn't do that because it was too difficult.
Anyway, Eleanor, what did you make of that analysis of the 1980s?
I don't really remember the 1970s, but and I'm not a historian or an economist.
Well, what he's saying,
I remember the 1980s.
Well, what he's saying effectively is that Labour made such a mess at the late 1970s that it needed someone tough like Thatcher to come along and sort things out, and that's what she did. He calls it an economic miracle there.
I remember the social impact of the Thatcher years. I remember as a child coming down the motorway to go and visit my grandparents and seeing police, riot police on the bridges over the motorway, watching out for miners coming from Sheffield and the rest of South Yorkshire from the area where I lived. There was a real sense of enmity. You know, I remember Orgreave, I remember Hillsborough, I remember the complete breakdown of society that happened in the Thatcher years. And that is not something that I would like to see us return to.
Martin, ultimately, there is one of the interesting things he was talking about there was the disaster that nationalisation was, you know, this kind of infinite amount of borrowing to try and keep these industries going. This idea that some industries just can't go bust. But then we've seen that, haven't we, really, with the banks, in that we've got a kind of socialism for the banks, but it's a dying capitalism for everyone else.
Well, that's right. I mean, the hypocrisy of this is unbelievable. Because when the banking system collapsed, money's no object to bail it out. Now, if you think about things like the water industry,
something like 800 billion. Hang on a sec, folks. It was around about £800 billion used to bail the banks out. So, you know, if you think about what that would do in the rest of the economy,
yeah,
I mean that is indeed a substantial
and of
amount
course,
of money.
Let's just take a for instance, an obvious one: the water industry. Now, in Scotland, Scottish Water is still owned by the Scottish government, and therefore people have low bills. They get water for cost, and that's what they do. In Ireland, until the crisis, water was free, absolutely free. People didn't have to pay for it. It was paid through general taxation. And, of course, it's actually an infrastructure. The argument in favour of nationalisation in the 1940s is that certain things are infrastructural. You can't really have competition, for example, in the railway,
water,
which is why they've still got a nationalised railway in Russia.
I mean,
water
should be free as it is in Ireland. I mean,
well,
it's
indeed.
Just one of those. If it's a human right, why should you have to pay for it anyway?
Well, indeed.
Eleanor, what do you make of all this?
I think that different industries, different activities need organising at different levels. You're absolutely right that having a national railway divided up into separate competitive business units makes no sense at all. If I want to go to Norwich, then it's no good to me that there's a train to Brighton that's really cheap. I want to go to Norwich, and so I'm not going to be able to take advantage
Actually,
of any
I'm
kind
sorry,
of competition.
I'm sorry, the trains to Brighton are not running today.
the argument in favour of nationalisation of certain industries is to do with the structure of technology that you're using. Some industries have got a very competitive structure, and I think the argument in favour of having privatised telecoms industry was a good one because the technology had changed. When people used to have a line to their house with the phone, it was made sense to have a national network. But when you've got phone, everybody's got a phone and so on, then it makes sense to have a private sector competitive structure. But some things just haven't got a competitive structure. There is only one set of pipes bringing water to my house, and Wessex Water charge me £40 a month for a bed sit where I haven't even got I've got a shower and a tap.
Don't talk to me about Bristol Water.
Well, indeed,
I've had a battle with them for the last three or four years.
And I think
even
Tory voters can see that it's a rip-off. And don't forget that in the same Tory conference that we were just talking about, Theresa May promised that she was going to cap the prices of these private utilities. And, of course, the logic of that ultimately is, well, why don't we just have them run by the public like they were for donkey's years?
Okay.
And they didn't make a profit because they weren't supposed to make a profit.
Let's move on through the conference. Next up, it's Boris. And here's a little sample of his foreign policy. Before we hear Boris, do you both think he's going to be the next leader after Theresa May? Eleanor, what do you think?
I really hope not.
Well, I don't want him to be the leader either, but he may well end up being one because he's the sort of clown that the jokers want, isn't he?
As I absorb the general tone of the national conversation, I don't think I have ever known so many to be sunk in gloom and dubitation about Britain and the world. Every week, I pick up a fine British edited international news magazine of the kind that you'll find in the briefcases of jet-setting consultants, glossy, covered, elegantly written, suspiciously unread. Every week, these publications have found new reasons to be slightly less than cheerful about this country. Every day, a distinguished pink newspaper manages to make Eeyore look positively exuberant. And across the world, it pains me to say it, across the world, the impression is being given that this country is not up to it, that we're going to bottle out of Brexit and end up in some dingy anteroom of the EU, pathetically waiting for the scraps, but no longer in control of the menu. And the most pessimistic of them all is not the media or our friends in the EU Commission or the excitable Monsieur Guy Verhofstadt. Far from it, it's Jeremy Corbyn, that NATO-bashing trident strapping would-be abolisher of the British Army, whose first instinct, in the event of almost any international outrage or disaster, is to upend the analysis until he can find a way of blaming British foreign policy, and whose response to the grisly events in Venezuela is to side with the regime simply because they are fellow lefties. He says he still admires Bolivarian revolutionary socialism. I say he's Caracas. And it's beyond satire. It's beyond satire. At a time when the world should unite to condemn Venezuela's Maduro, we have the leader of Britain's official opposition giving cover to a government that is jailing opponents, shooting demonstrators, intimidating journalists, and repressing human rights. It is a disgrace. And I can tell you, there are many Labour MPs who feel appalled that their party is still led by this man, with his peculiar belief expressed in glutinous victory-style rallies up and down the country that he somehow won the election. He didn't win. You won. We won. 56 seats ahead.
Well, you have to admit that he gives the Tory activists what they want, but I don't know that that makes him prime ministerial.
Well, I mean, it's where does one begin with the sort of unseriousness of this fellow? He talks about Venezuela. He doesn't want to talk about Saudi Arabia, where children are dying every day because of his foreign policy. And of course, later
actually,
on...
Actually, can I just come in there? Because there was the end of last year, there was a bomb in a funeral which killed 150 people in Yemen, dropped by the Saudis with probably a British bomb, actually, and maybe even dropped by a British aircraft on that funeral. And there was a legal challenge to whether supplying weapons to the Saudi Arabians. And Boris said, oh, no, it's fine to do that. And in fact, he even tried to influence the courts to make sure, and at which the courts then did decide, yes, it's perfectly legal to carry on supplying weapons to these people who are killing people at mourners at funeral. Now, I don't think an aircraft versus mourners at a funeral is really an equal war.
No, it's not. And of course, we're not talking... you mentioned Venezuela, but you didn't want to mention Brazil, where the elected president was pushed out by a Wall Street-backed coup supported by the British. He doesn't want to mention Mexico, where tens of thousands of people are dying every day, because the regime in Mexico, they don't actually have free elections in Mexico, but the result is pro-US, so we don't hear anything about it. We didn't hear about Colombia when I went on a trade union delegation there in 2005. Trade unionists journalists and peasant leaders are constantly being executed, tortured, killed, all supported by the British. BP, for example, in Casanare in southern Colombia have an oil field, and they carried out a hit using SAS personnel on a environmental regulator, shot him dead in front of his family. But we don't hear anything about that, because that's actually real stuff that's going on in the real world.
I mean, Eleanor, what do you make about Britain's foreign policy under Boris?
I think his clowning is quite a distraction. I think people see him being this bumbling, blonde-haired buffoon and find it laughable or a little charming, depending on their view on the world. But underneath that, I think he's a dangerous man. I think what he's doing, as you said, backing Saudi Arabian arms sales is a dangerous path to tread in the world. And it's lives are cost.
It's something like 6,000 civilians dead now in Yemen. Poorest country in... But Britain's made around about £4 billion in arms sales. But anyway, that's Boris is signing those off, folks. But there was also a criticism of him last night on BBC's Question Time by Sarah Churchwell, and she's an American, and I was quite surprised to see an American on there. But anyway, she had this to say about Boris.
The specific comments that he made about Libya a country that is mired in civil war, and he said it had nice beaches that would be good to invest in once they cleared up the dead bodies. That's not a joke. It's not funny. It's not appropriate for the foreign minister of Great Britain to say. He should have been sacked instantly. It's one of the reasons I say Theresa May is a follower and not a leader, that she didn't do that right away. And I find it absolutely despicable that anybody is defending him or defending those comments.
Well, I think fair to say probably the biggest round of applause I've seen for a few weeks on Question Time. You can actually nod off sometimes while that programme's on. But and this is pretty serious, isn't it, saying things like this. We've had actually a complaint from the Libyan embassy too against asking for an immediate apology, but no reply so far.
I wouldn't hold your breath to wait for an apology out of Boris Johnson. I think he thinks he can just smile and smooth his way out of it. And I really don't think that Theresa May feels her position is strong enough to stand up to him and make him apologise.
Martin, it's almost like it makes the Duke of Edinburgh look positively tame.
Yes, and he's in charge. And of course, we're mentioning Libya. The British intelligence services and special forces basically engineered the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya, and leading to the chaos and bloodshed that we now see. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, Al-Qaeda Libya, were the Manchester bomber was connected to them, and they're based in Manchester, and they've always been based in Manchester because British intelligence services have been working with those kind of Islamist groups against the Syrians, against the Libyans, against the Afghan government in the 1980s for years and years and years. It's
okay.
A big open secret.
Okay.
Britain supports jihadi terrorism.
Okay.
They always have.
So let's have a listen now to Theresa May's speech where she's talking about housing.
The effects of the financial crisis, nearly a decade of low growth, stagnating wages and pay restraint linger. The boom in the housing market means that while some have done very well, for many, the chance of getting onto the housing ladder has become a distant dream. And it's that fact, perhaps more than any other, that means for too many, the British dream is increasingly out of reach. Just over a decade ago, 59% of 25 to 34-year-olds owned their own home. Today, it is just 38%. Now, it's always been a great sadness for me and Philip that we were never blessed with children. It seems some things in life are just never meant to be. But I believe in the dream that life should be better for the next generation as much as any mother, any father, any grandparent. The only difference is that I have the privileged position of being able to do more than most to bring that dream to life. So I will dedicate my premiership to fixing this problem. Thank you. Thank you. Dedicate it to restoring hope, to renewing the British dream for a new generation of people. And yes, that means fixing our broken housing market. For 30 or 40 years, we simply haven't built enough homes. As a result, prices have risen so much that the average home now costs almost 8 times average earnings. And that's been a disaster for young people in particular. Now, we have begun to put this right. The number of new homes being delivered each year has increased significantly since 2010. Our housing white paper set out plans to increase it further, ensuring councils release more land for housing and giving them new powers to ensure that developers actually build homes once they're given planning permission to do so. And because it will take time for greater house building to translate into more affordable house prices, we've introduced schemes like Help to Buy to support people who are struggling right now. But the election result showed us that this is not nearly enough. We've listened and we've learned. So this week, the Chancellor announced that we will help over 130,000 more families with the deposit they need to buy their own home by investing a further £10 billion in Help to Buy. We've announced measures to give the increasing number of families who rent from a private landlord more security and effective redress if their landlord is not maintaining their property. And today, I can announce that we will invest an additional £2 billion in affordable housing, taking the government's total affordable housing budget to almost £9 billion. We will encourage councils as well as housing associations to bid for this money and provide certainty over future rent levels. And in those parts of the country where the need is greatest, allow homes to be built for social rent well below market level. Getting government back into the business of building houses, a new generation of council houses to help fix our broken housing market. So whether you're trying to buy your own home, renting privately and looking for more security, or have been waiting for years on a council list, help is on the way. It won't be quick or easy, but as Prime Minister, I'm going to make it my mission to solve this problem, and I'll take personal charge of the government's response and make the British dream a reality by reigniting home ownership in Britain once again. And let me say one more thing. I want to send the clearest possible message to our house builders. We, the government, will make sure the land is available, will make sure our young people have the skills you need. In return, you must do your duty to Britain and build the homes our country needs. And
that's Theresa May's speech there, talking about housing at the Tory conference this week. Eleanor, the British dream. It always seems like it's almost trying to copy the American dream, but I don't know. Did it work?
Yes, it didn't really work for me. I don't think in Britain we're quite so prone to that kind of gung-ho, aren't we marvellous with our dream sort of thing. I don't think it really washes here.
On Twitter, you were mentioning, you saw some
I saw some lovely things. Alan Partridge, I think, was given as an example of the British dream, or a custard cream.
Somebody's saying on Twitter, the British dream is that the Tories never get so much of a whiff of power ever again and that we stop bombing other countries.
Well, obviously, I think what's interesting about that speech is the commitment to council housing. She wants more owner occupation, and she's going to give some more handouts to people who want to buy houses who are already quite wealthy, but she's also going to build some council houses. Hooray!
Finally, something on terrorism.
4 months ago, this city came under attack from those who hate our country and despise our values. The liberty we extend to everyone, whoever they are and wherever they are from. The way in which our society is open, accepting and tolerant of others. The fact that we celebrate diversity and champion difference. The way we encourage people from all backgrounds and beliefs to live their lives in freedom, to be all they want to be. And because of this hatred, they chose to take out their rage on the defenceless and vulnerable, the innocent and the young. Let us be in no doubt. The responsibility for such an outrage lies with no one other than those who planned it and those who saw it through. And this party, which knows the terrible toll of terrorism all too well, will never seek to justify or excuse such acts of terror. We will stand strong in the face of terrorism and ensure our values always prevail. But what we remember most from the cowardly attack on the Manchester Arena is the response of the spirit of Manchester. No. We remember We remember that spirit.
I think we're going to fade out there. It was a bit of an awful cough she had, Martin.
It was, and of course she's mentioning the terrorism and so on. Of course, in Syria and in Libya, British Special Forces and Intelligence Service have been working very closely with Islamists to overthrow those regimes. And of course, the Manchester bomber, his father fought with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group working with the SAS to overthrow Gaddafi. That's probably how the people around him knew how to build a viable bomb, because we've trained them.
Well, thank you. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest leader of the Green Group and councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down, Eleanor